Have you ever put on a figurative mask to project who you want to be rather than who you really are? Or to put on a mask to keep people from finding out you may not be as good as they think you are? You'll hear about masks in the next few minutes on Voices from the Mighty Pen Project here on the Virginia Voice. And for the Virginia Voice, I'm Lou Dean. With me is Christopher Topher Murphy, who is an Army psychologist with the rank of captain. He served a tour in Iraq, he received the Combat Action Badge, and an Army Commendation Medal, among other recognitions. Here is Topher Murphy reading Wearing Masks in War. It's a story he wrote while participating in the Mighty Pen Project, founded by author David L. Robbins, in partnership with the Virginia War Memorial.
Wearing Mask in War. The compound was a simple piece of land. T-walls formed a perimeter on the west and southwest. The rest of the perimeter consisted of old Iraqi barracks that had been shuttered with sandbags covering the windows. The crush of gravel could be heard when my team and I walked to the latrine or out to the truck. Gravel is everywhere in Iraq. Gravel served as an early warning alarm for approaching vehicles and pedestrians. Our compound measured 70 meters by 40 meters. The living area consisted of a rectangular building in the center. Walking to the clinic each morning started with a left out of the door and a 10-meter walk to another door on the left. This was the home of the Taji Combat Stress Control Team. Several hundred meters to our west was MSR Tampa. This no-man's land consisted of several abandoned buildings. Walking across this parcel of land would lead to HESCO barriers. After another 10 or 20 meters towered the T-walls known as Alaska barriers. The tallest of the T-walls, they stood 20 feet tall. The majority of Fob Taji is enclosed in their protective grip. If anything or anyone came across that wall, we, my team that is, would be a speed bump on the way to the main force. To our east was the main concentration of firepower. This firepower consisted of an infantry battalion as well as several aviation assets. A quarter of a mile from us resided the closest friendly on the east side of the FOB. The placement of our compound is the proverbial double-edged sword. The positive allowed soldiers in need to have a sense of anonymity and allowed our team to have brief periods of downtime. Our placement was due to past deployments, which initially allowed combat stress to be centralized, but now we were isolated from others, which caused a safety concern, which was the negative. However, at this point, we enjoyed our compound and accepted the inherent risk location-wise. This deployment was focused on turning off the lights. The drawdown in Iraq rolled along. The closing of smaller outposts and camps provided evidence of this mission. The withdrawal of troops continued. However, due to Taji being a major aviation stopover, the insurgents marked it as a high priority place to attack. We've been attacked previously, but thankfully St. Michael watched over us and no one had been killed. On an early Monday morning, we prepared for another mission. Schmitty and I would be going out with an engineering team. These were called walkabouts, generally psychologists or wizards, as the warfighters called us, didn't go outside the wire. The plan was to interact with the units outside the wire. We were there as observers. The idea was to build rapport with the units as well as attempting to destigmatize mental health. We were not to, quote unquote, provide services, as the engineering major stated pre-mission. We checked our weapons. The click of slides going back and forth, the clinking of bullets being placed in magazines, echoed throughout our day room. The day room was a large open area with tables and cabinets where we stored our gear and other supplies. Immediately off the day room were four bedrooms. The Republican Guard had previously resided in these buildings. The cinder blocks had been covered with a mud-like substance that had hardened into a form of concrete. We heard the sound of crushing gravel. Like a mother knows the cries of her children, we identified that sound as a large vehicle. Our ride had arrived. I holstered my weapon and began gathering my equipment. Body armor is a great advancement in battlefield technology. However, I never enjoyed wearing it. With all my required gear, I would be wearing an additional 70 pounds. As I placed it over my shoulders, I felt the weight of the sappy plates. Yet the plates felt light compared to the crushing weight of responsibility and fear that always came over me. As we walked towards the door, I put on one of my masks. We got into the Humvee for the short trip across the FOB. We arrived at the gate and were waved through by a Ugandan security guard who had a loaded AK-47. We proceeded through the town square of El Taji. According to information provided, the town had a population of almost 500,000 people. We rarely saw any adults. A few children waved. The children were conditioned to believe candy or toys were provided by Americans. Today was no different. An eerie haze floated over the town. It could have been a town square from Middle America, the biggest difference being the beige coating of dust and sand on everything. Iraq is almost monochromatic. I hadn't seen green in 10 months since I'd been in Iraq. Everything lay in shades of tan and brown. We pulled over and dismounted near our objective. Today consisted of a check-in with the local engineering unit. Their mission included teaching the Iraqis how to build a bridge, this one over the Euphrates River. Although it was only 8 o'clock in the morning, my clothes were soaked with sweat. The temperature read 110 degrees and would only get hotter. As we approached the bridge, the frustration and irritation permeated throughout the site. A young soldier, perhaps 19 years old, wearing full body armor, hammered a bolt through a joint on the bridge. He balanced carefully on an 18-inch steel beam 2 stories off the ground. A perfect target. No weapon, focused on his job, no complaining. The frustration continued to mount. The enlisted soldiers caught the fever from the enlisted, who in turn had been infected by the officer in charge. The Iraqis were nowhere in sight. The young soldiers building a bridge for their counterparts, who were supposed to learn how to build bridges as well as learning maintenance. Yet again, they were completely finishing the work that the Iraqis were supposed to be doing. The erosion of trust continued, like an ocean wave crashing against a sandy outlook. Our Iraqi army counterparts showed up just as the engineering unit finished the day's work. The feeling of betrayal evident in the body language of the American soldiers. This mirrored previous instances where soldiers would go to predetermined missions only to be ambushed. Were they watching our response style, our setup, our numbers? This was bad juju. We finished our mission and headed back to the compound. We cleaned and stowed our gear. A shower followed. Washing the grime and sand off brought some relief from the heat. I put on another mask. We got into our F-150 pickup and headed over to the DFAC. We always placed a faded yellow and blue hacky sack on the dashboard. Otherwise, we would have been one of 200 white F-150 pickups to try and choose from. Ah, Taco Tuesday at the DFAC. We named each night based on the cuisine served. Taco Tuesday was the best. Gooch, a first-generation Mexican-American on our team, had his own stash of sauces and spices he used to make it more authentic. We got our food to go and headed back to the compound. We would eat dinner and watch a movie in Gooch's room. He lived in the biggest room. The perk of the biggest room came with extra responsibility. The tenant of the room had the responsibility of manning the comms for the team. As we rolled up to the compound, we couldn't shake the ominous premonition that something wasn't right. The sky mimicked the landscape, presenting as a hazy shade of light bluish gray. Briefly, the sun broke through the clouds and disappeared into an orange and red mist on the horizon. We ate while watching some forgettable movie and then signed off for the night. I shook off my premonition of danger as superstition. So far, nothing had happened. I hadn't heard or seen anything through official or unofficial sources that supported my premonition. My room lay on the opposite side of the day room from Gooch. I entered and shut the thick wooden door and engaged the lock. I then placed a towel at the bottom of the door, a safety procedure I'd learned from one of my brothers. Someone looking at my room from the outside would believe it's empty as there's no light escaping. I allowed myself one guilty pleasure, soft carpet for my bootless feet. My room measured 8 feet by 15 feet, set up in a rectangle. A makeshift combination of plywood and 2x4s formed a desk. The twin bed occupied the back of the room, the desk placed next to the head of the bed. This placement allowed easy access to my sidearm as well as a place for my laptop. I cleaned my weapon one more time before laying down. I sent my wife a brief email. "Hey babe, love you. Nothing much here. Can't wait to be home. I'll see you in a couple months. Don't worry, I'm safe." Another mask worn, another one removed. I placed my sidearm on the desk next to my head. It was locked, cocked, and ready to rock. Sleep covered me like a warm blanket in a winter storm. Occasionally I'd stir and hear the whoop, whoop, whoop of helicopters leaving the airfield and heading out on unknown missions. Although they were a half a mile away, I could still hear them over the purring of the air conditioning unit in my room. Sleep came over me. Wa-boom! Wa-boom! The echoes of destruction bouncing off buildings woke me from my sleep. Confusion briefly greeted me as I woke. Was I dreaming? Wa-boom! 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 I turned off the AC. The elimination of stimuli would help determine what was going on. The emotionless announcement of incoming, 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 in conjunction with the loud blaring horn, jarred me into reality. We were under attack. I grabbed my weapon, slid on my Crocs while grabbing my extra ammo. I wanted my Crocs in case I needed to move quickly because I didn't have time to tie my boots. I entered officer mode. I raced through what I was supposed to do. Go to bunker. No, I'm in a cinder block building. I'm not dying today while running from a brick building to a concrete tunnel. Check on team. Schmitty bangs on the wall as his room butts up against mine. I know he's okay. Shit, what about Gooch? Three loud knocks on my door. Who's knocking on my door in the middle of a mortar attack? Sir, you awake? It's Gooch. I open up the door. He looks at me like... Of course, people always answer knocking doors while holding sidearms, wearing Crocs, and army shorts. Okay, so Gooch is fine. Sir, we're getting mortared. No shit, Gooch. He turns and walks across the day room back to his comms. It's surreal how disconnected he is from possible death. I close my door. I sit next to my bed and begin to pray. Lord, please let me live. But if I'm gonna die, make it quick. Don't let me suffer or have horrible injuries. I don't want to go home in a body bag. Wa-boom. 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 Like a never-ending drum beat the mortars, which kept dropping. Why now? What is going on? Without my mask to protect me, the demons appear. Hopelessness. Helplessness. I'm sure there's others. When's the next one coming? Where is it landing? Are my friends going to die? The demons question my ability, my choices, my leadership. I briefly engage them. Suddenly, a deafening clap rings in my ears as a mortar lands outside my wall. I look up at my wall as plaster is falling on my bed and a crack appears in my wall. Anger washes over me with its friend adrenaline. I quickly put on a mask. Counting. I need to count. I start tracking the mortars and start with 10... for the first few that I most likely missed. I count up to 30. I look at my watch, but it's not there. Suddenly I remember I took it off when I was cleaning my gear yesterday. I'm guessing that 45 minutes or so has passed since the first mortar hit. Just then we get the all clear. The same emotionless voice repeats all clear several times. I leave my room. Stein put on a different mask and go to work. However, as I rush out to take off my mask and forget to grab a new one. As a team, we check in briefly and then headed for the roof. We wanted to check out the damage. Like lava steps on the ladder, the heat increases the metal and the temperature rises with the sun. I find it hard to climb the steps as I try to avoid burning my hands. I realized I haven't even holstered my pistol, which is currently in my right hand. At the top of the ladder, we have a 360-degree view of the FOB. To the northeast, we can see the medical clinic. Due east, we observe the evidence of carnage from the destructive power of the unanswered attack. The flight line has been hit. We see an eerie orange glow in different spots. Quickly, I review my mental map of Taji and try to determine whose area has been hit. Sir, you okay? It's Schmitty. His question jars me back to my surroundings. He sees me without a mask. He sees me vulnerable. Quickly looking away, he adjusts his own mask. I'm an officer, a doctor, a male. I'm not supposed to feel. Gooch and Schmitty glance at me and then remark about completing various tasks. I'm the last off the roof. I stand there with my own demons. They come and go, but currently I'm surrounded by those named incapable, fatigued, vulnerable, powerless, infuriated. These are the ones I readily can see and can identify. You okay, boss? Schmitty yells up the ladder. The day has started with a thunderous applause of carnage and hatred. I climb down, quickly changing to my uniform. No shower this morning. I don't want to die naked while I'm showering. No breakfast either. The DFAC is too big a target. The team grabs Clif bars and Gatorade protein drinks. Each of us engages in tasks that are second nature to us. Gooch is calling the command. Schmitty is checking in with medical assets, while I answer calls from various units. Some are friends checking in. Others are requesting our services. Amazingly, only one person was wounded. Poor kid was running to a bunker as a shrapnel bounced across the runway. His shoulder is broken and shredded, but he'll make it. He becomes a Purple Heart recipient just trying to get to safety and because he followed the rules. Communication is limited due to Army protocol. They don't want unfiltered information leaving a war zone, such as the announcement of someone killed in action or wounded. We drive to the different units and check in. I'm wearing my favorite mask. I've used it many times over the years. It's like an old t-shirt that becomes more comfortable and familiar over time. Demons notwithstanding, the mask has adjusted to different experiences and scenarios. Schmitty and I walk into the second of the 227 Aviation Brigade compound. Gooch is at our compound manning the comms. We check in with the commander as well as the soldiers who were on the flight line just a few short hours ago. Most of the soldiers have their mask on, yet there are a few that don't. Those without masks show vulnerability. I see fear, anger, worry, helplessness, and some hopelessness. The ones without their mask will be at the clinic within a few days. Be that as it may, it's the one with mask that worry me. Like me, they are hiding from the demons. As we leave, I hear a young soldier talking to his battle buddy. I wish I could be like Captain Murphy. He's brave and not scared of anything. My mask, my friend. The symbiotic relationship is a delicate balance. The balance between allowing others to see the demons or become lost in the mask. This is the life of a warrior and healer. I sit at my desk, alone in my office. The old leather couch behind me is creased with 1,000 psychological issues and concerns. The floor has been worn smooth by the tears of loss and fear. I stare at my own countdown calendar. 68 days left. Will I make it home? Do I leave my mask? Daily, I peer behind others' masks. I prepare them to battle their own demons. Sometimes, they are also mine. As the wizard, I arm them with weapons for psychological warfare. So far, most are winning their battles. Those injured I have sent home. Did I do enough? I think of my many masks. The Iliad stares at me from the corner of my desk. The worn corners remind me of the path home faced by many warriors. My odyssey has just started. I am a soldier, husband, officer, and doctor. I am all of these and none of these when I wear a mask. I hear the shuffling of feet and crude joking from my team as they enter the clinic. It's time for dinner. The homeostasis of morbid humor, friendly teasing, and being politically incorrect is back. We drive to the DFAC and pick up dinner. After today, we'll eat in our own rooms, then hit golf balls off the roof. As we're leaving the DFAC, we see a major walking to his compound. Offering him a ride, he gladly accepts to enjoy a brief respite from the stifling heat. A few minutes later, we arrive at his compound. He thanks us for the ride. He begins to walk away but stops. Turning around, he asks, "Doc, you take care of us. Who takes care of you?" He doesn't wait for an answer and just moves into his compound.
Thank you, Topher. Topher Murphy reading his story, Wearing Masks in War. He wrote the story during his participation in the Mighty Pen Project. The Mighty Pen Project was founded by best-selling author David L. Robbins in partnership with the Virginia War Memorial. Topher, in the story you just read, you speak of the different masks that you and others around you put on, sometimes to keep your feelings or your insecurities from showing. Are you wearing a mask right now?
Not really sure. People call them hats, masks. I generally have to put on at work the all-knowing, all-wise doctor, but just like everybody else, have fears and concerns, anxieties.
Give us a sense of what it's like to be a psychologist in a war zone.
Okay. Interestingly, a lot of people ask that question and automatically assume I deal with a lot of PTSD. The reality is it's dealing with being away from home. It's dealing with being separated from loved ones. Although you're around friends, being around friends 24/7 gets old very quickly, and so you get on each other's nerves quicker. It's also working with commands to help them understand the psychology behind being deployed, as well as how people will react in different situations.
You mentioned people think of PTSD, but that's mostly after they get home. You were dealing with things that are happening right then and there.
Correct. So, again, I think it's really just a misnomer, maybe misunderstanding of how PTSD develops, but unfortunately, I think there's a misbelief that, well, if you're a soldier and you've deployed, then you have PTSD, and that's what Captain Murphy or Dr. Murphy would be dealing with. Again, there's a lot of transition issues and being away from home, loss of control, not being able to, you know, help the wife or girlfriend when there's a flat tire, the lawnmower doesn't work, or the water heater breaks, and just that kind of loss of control.
In your story early on, you described the area as being very tan, very no green.
Right.
And that's very foreign to people here in, let's say, Richmond, Virginia, which has a lot of green.
Correct. That's the one striking thing to me about Iraq, is when we flew in, you could see an overview of the Euphrates and Tigris, and it's very fertile there, but as you move out from the edges of the river, everything is basically a desert, hence the tan and brown colors. I didn't write about it, but there was a guy on the team before me who actually had seeds of grass sent to him, and he grew like 4x4 patch of grass when he was on Iraq, just so he could feel like he was at home.
Tell me about the Mighty Pen Project. How did it help you put your words, your thoughts, onto paper?
The Mighty Pen Project was actually introduced to me by a fellow veteran, and I'd always thought about writing some of the things down, but I didn't know how to start or where to start. And when I signed up and took the class with David Robbins, not only did he teach how to write your thoughts down, and it wasn't a focus on the semicolon goes here, that's an adverb and not an adjective, but it was learning how to tell your story, painting a picture so other people can understand it. I guess for me, the biggest thing as a psychologist was seeing people who have been in therapy for a while, but found the Mighty Pen Project to be more therapeutic in the sense I'm with 12 other veterans. They understand what's going on. I can write my story and don't have to try and explain things. Whereas, in all honesty, sometimes therapy can be very regimented, short periods of time. And so I could see them exploring their own stories or using their stories as parallels for personal experiences from past conflicts.
Unlike yours, many readers have told terrible stories of war, of losing buddies, seeing horrible destruction of not just buildings but human beings, and it has stayed with them. And it seems like the Mighty Pen Project is a way of releasing that for them.
Correct. I would agree with that. I have talked to the founder, David Robbins, although, again, not expressly a therapeutic setting. It still ends up being therapeutic for them. There's something about being able to write it down in story form and going at their own pace that helps them get it out and talk through it. And when you write your story, the following week, the fellow members provide feedback. And again, it's not grammatical. It's, you know, help me understand this, or what point of view is this coming from? Or sometimes, and we've actually had it in a couple classes, where people would say something, for example, well, actually, I was on the hill across the way, and the reason we couldn't come rescue you was because there was this tank battalion behind you, and if we'd gone down, we would have gotten captured too. And it helps lead to resolution. Again, although not an intentional therapeutic process, it is very therapeutic for those with their stories.
Again, thank you, Topher. Topher Murphy is a participant in the Mighty Pen Project. Voices from the Mighty Pen Project is a series here on The Virginia Voice. And for The Virginia Voice, I'm Lou Dean.